Chapters from My Autobiography, Chapter 19, by Mark Twain. From Susie's Biography of Me. March 23, 1886. The other day was my birthday, and I had a little birthday party in the evening, and Papa acted some very funny charades with Mr. Gerhardt, Mr. Jesse Grant, who had come up from New York and was spending the evening with us, and Mr. Frank Warner. One of them was On His Knees, Honey Sneeze. There were a good many other funny ones, all of which I don't remember. Mr. Grant was very pleasant, and began playing the charades in the most delightful way. Susie's spelling has defeated me this time. I cannot make out what Honey Sneeze stands for. Impromptu charades were almost a nightly pastime of ours from the children's earliest days. They played in them with me when they were only 5 or 6 years old. As they increased in years and practice, their love for the sport almost amounted to a passion, and they acted their parts with a steadily increasing ability. At first they required much drilling, but later they were generally ready as soon as the parts were assigned, and they acted them according to their own devices. Their stage facility and absence of constraint and self-consciousness in The Prince and Pauper was a result of their charading practice. At 10 and 12, Susie wrote plays, and she and Daisy Warner and Clara played them in the library or upstairs in the schoolroom, with only themselves and the servants for audience. They were of a tragic and tremendous sort, and were performed with great energy and earnestness. They were dramatized freely from English history, and in them Mary Queen of Scots and Elizabeth had few holidays. The clothes were borrowed from the mother's wardrobe, and the gowns were longer than necessary, but that was not regarded as a defect. In one of these plays, Jean, 3 years old, perhaps, was Sir Francis Bacon. She was not dressed for the part, and did not have to say anything, but sat silent and decorous at a tiny table, and was kept busy signing death warrants. It was a really important office, for few entered those plays and got out of them alive. March 26th. Papa and Mama have been in New York for 2 or 3 days, and Miss Corey has been staying with us. They are coming home today at 2 o'clock. Papa has just begun to play chess, and he is very fond of it, so he has engaged to play with Mrs. Charles Warner every morning from 10 to 12. He came down to supper last night full of this pleasant prospect, but evidently with something on his mind. Finally he said to Mama in an apologetical tone, "Susie Warner and I have a plan." "Well," Mama said, "what now, I wonder?" Papa said that Susie Warner and he were going to name the chessmen after some of the old Bible heroes, and then play chess on Sunday. April 18, 1886. Mama and Papa, Clara and Delcy have gone to New York to see the Mikado. They are coming home tonight at 7:30. Last winter, when Mr. Cable was lecturing with Papa, he wrote this letter to him just before he came to visit. "Dear Uncle, that's one nice thing about me. I never bother anyone to offer me a good thing twice. You don't ask me to stay over Sunday, but then you don't ask me to leave Saturday night. And knowing the nobility of your nature as I do, thank you. I'll stay till Monday morning. Note, Cable never traveled Sundays. Yours and the dear family's, George W. Cable." December 22, 1906. It seems a prodigious while ago. 2 or 3 nights ago I dined at a friend's house with a score of other men, and at my side with Cable, actually almost an old man, well, really almost an old man, that once so young chap. 62 years old, frost on his head, 7 grandchildren in stock, and a brand new wife to re-begin life with. Dictated November 19, 1906. Ever since Papa and Mama were married, Papa has written his books and then taken them to Mama in manuscript, and she has expurgated them. Papa read Huckleberry Finn to us in manuscript just before it came out, and then he would leave parts of it with Mama to expurgate while he went off up to the study to work. And sometimes Clara and I would be sitting with Mama while she was looking the manuscript over, and I remember so well with what pangs of regret we used to see her turn down the leaves of the pages, which meant that some delightfully dreadful part must be scratched out. And I remember one part particularly, which was perfectly fascinating, it was dreadful, that Clara and I used to delight in, and oh, with what despair we saw Mama turn down the leaf on which it was written. We thought the book would be almost ruined without it, but we gradually came to feel as Mama did. It would be a pity to replace the vivacity and quaintness and felicity of Susie's innocent free spelling with the dull and petrified uniformities of the spelling-book. Nearly all the grimness is taken out of the expurgating of my books by the subtle mollification accidentally infused into the word by Susie's modification of the spelling of it. I remember the special case mentioned by Susie, and can see the group yet, two-thirds of it pleading for the life of the culprit sentence that was so fascinatingly dreadful, and the other third of it patiently explaining why the court could not grant the prayer of the pleaders. But I do not remember what the condemned phrase was. It had much company, and they all went to the gallows. But it is possible that that specially dreadful one which gave those little people so much delight was cunningly devised and put into the book for just that function, and not with any hope or expectation that it would get by the expurgator alive. It is possible, for I had that custom. Susie's quaint and effective spelling falls quite opportunely into today's atmosphere, which is heavy with the rumblings and grumblings and mutterings of the simplified spelling reform. Andrew Carnegie started this storm a couple of years ago by moving a simplifying of English orthography and establishing a fund for the prosecution and maintenance of the crusade. He began gently. He addressed a circular to some hundreds of his friends, asking them to simplify the spelling of a dozen of our badly spelt words. I think they were only words which end with the superfluous U-G-H. He asked that these friends use the suggested spellings in their private correspondence. By this, one perceives that the beginning was sufficiently quiet and unaggressive. Next stage, a small committee was appointed, with Brander Matthews for managing director and spokesman. It issued a list of 300 words of average silliness as to spelling, and proposed new and sane spellings for these words. The President of the United States, unsolicited, adopted these simplified 300 officially, and ordered that they be used in the official documents of the government. It was now remarked by all the educated and the thoughtful, except the clergy, that shell, S-H-E-O-L, was to pay. This was most justly and comprehensively descriptive. The indignant British lion rose with a roar that was heard across the Atlantic and stood there on his little isle, gazing red-eyed out over the glooming seas, snow-flecked with driving spindrift and lashing his tail, a most scary spectacle to see. The lion was outraged because we, a nation of children, without any grown-up people among us, with no property in the language, but using it merely by courtesy of its owner, the English nation, were trying to defile the sacredness of it by removing from it peculiarities which had been its ornament and which had made it holy and beautiful for ages. In truth, there is a certain sardonic propriety in preserving our orthography, since ours is a mongrel language which started with a child's vocabulary of 300 words, and now consists of 225,000, the whole lot, with the exception of the original and legitimate 300, borrowed, stolen, smooched from every unwatched language under the sun, the spelling of each individual word of the lot locating the source of the theft and preserving the memory of the revered crime. Why is it that I have intruded into this turmoil and manifested a desire to get our orthography purged of its asininities? Indeed, I do not know why I should manifest any interest in the matter, for at bottom I disrespect our orthography most heartily, and as heartily disrespect everything that has been said by anybody in defense of it. Nothing professing to be a defense of our ludicrous spellings has had any basis, so far as my observation goes, except sentimentality. In these arguments the term venerable is used instead of moldy, and hallowed instead of devilish, whereas there is nothing properly venerable or antique about a language which is not yet 400 years old, and about a jumble of imbecile spellings which were grotesque in the beginning, and which grow more and more grotesque with the flight of the years. Dictated Monday, November 30th, 1906. Jean and Papa were walking out past the barn the other day when Jean saw some little newly born baby ducks She exclaimed as she perceived them, "I don't see why God gives us so much ducks when Patrick kills them so."
Susie is mistaken as to the origin of the ducks. They were not a gift. I bought them. I am not finding fault with her, for that would be most unfair. She is remarkably accurate in her statements as a historian, as a rule, and it would not be just to make much of this small slip of hers. Besides, I think it was a quite natural slip, for by heredity and habit ours was a religious household, and it was a common thing with us, whenever anybody did a handsome thing, to give the credit of it to Providence, without examining into the matter. This may be called automatic religion. In fact, that is what it is. It is so used to its work that it can do it without our help or even your privity. Out of all the facts and statistics that may be placed before it, it will always get the one result, since it has never been taught to seek any other. It is thus the unreflecting cause of much injustice. As we have seen, it betrayed Susie into an injustice toward me. It had to be automatic, for she would have been far from doing me an injustice when in her right mind. It was a dear little biographer, and she meant me no harm, and I am not censuring her now, but am only desirous of correcting in advance an erroneous impression which her words would be sure to convey to a reader's mind. No elaboration of this matter is necessary. It is sufficient to say I provided the ducks. It was in Hartford. The greensward sloped downhill from the house to the sluggish little river that flowed through the grounds, and Patrick, who was fertile in good ideas, had early conceived the idea of having homemade ducks for our table. Every morning he drove them from the stable down to the river, and the children were always there to see and admire the waddling white procession. They were there again at sunset to see Patrick conduct the procession back to its lodgings in the stable. But this was not always a gay and happy holiday show, with joy in it for the witnesses. No, too frequently there was a tragedy connected with it, and then there were tears and pain for the children. There was a stranded log or two in the river, and on these certain families of snapping turtles used to congregate and drowse in the sun and give thanks, in their dumb way, to Providence for benevolence extended to them. It was but another instance of misplaced credit. It was the young ducks that those pious reptiles were so thankful for, whereas they were my ducks. I bought the ducks. When a crop of young ducks, not yet quite old enough for the table but approaching that age, began to join the procession and paddle around in the sluggish water and give thanks, not to me, for that privilege, the snapping turtles would suspend their songs of praise and slide off the logs and paddle along under the water and chew the feet of the young ducks. Presently Patrick would notice that two or three of those little creatures were not moving about, but were apparently at anchor, and were not looking as thankful as they had been looking a short time before. He early found out what that sign meant. A submerged snapping turtle was taking his breakfast, and silently singing his gratitude. Every day or two Patrick would rescue and fetch up a little duck with incomplete legs to stand upon, nothing left of their extremities but gnawed and bleeding stumps. Then the children said pitying things and wept, and at dinner we finished the tragedy which the turtles had begun. Thus, as will be seen, out of season, at least, it was really the turtles that gave us so much ducks, at my expense. Papa has written a new version of There Is a Happy Land. It is, "There is a boarding-house far, far away, where they have ham and eggs 3 times a day. Oh, don't those boarders yell when they hear the dinner bell? They give that landlord rats 3 times a day. Again, Susie has made a small error. It was not that I wrote the song. I heard Billy Rice sing it in the Negro Minstrel Show, and I brought it home and sang it, with great spirit, for the elevation of the household. The children admired it to the limit, and made me sing it with burdensome frequency. To their minds it was superior to the battle hymn of the Republic. How many years ago that was! Where now is Billy Rice? He was a joy to me, and so were the other stars of the nigger show, Billy Birch, David Wombold, Bacchus, and a delightful dozen of their brethren, who made life a pleasure to me 40 years ago and later. Birch, Wombold, and Bacchus are gone years ago, and with them departed to return no more forever, I suppose, the real nigger show, the genuine nigger show, the extravagant nigger show, the show which to me had no peer and whose peer has not yet arrived in my experience. We have the grand opera, and I have witnessed and greatly enjoyed the first act of everything which Wagner created, but the effect on me has always been so powerful that one act was quite sufficient. Whenever I have witnessed two acts, I have gone away physically exhausted, and whenever I have ventured an entire opera, the result has been the next thing to suicide. But if I could have the nigger show back again in its pristine purity and perfection, I should have but little further use for opera. It seems to me that to the elevated mind and the sensitive spirit, the hand organ and the nigger show are a standard and a summit to whose rarefied altitude the other forms of musical art may not hope to reach. Dictated September 5, 1906. It is years since I have examined the children's record. I have turned over a few of its pages this morning. This book is a record in which Mrs. Clemens and I registered some of the sayings and doings of the children in the long ago, when they were little chaps. Of course, we wrote these things down at the time because they were of momentary interest, things of the passing hour, and of no permanent value. But at this distant day I find that they still possess an interest for me, and also a value, because it turns out that they were registrations of character. The qualities then revealed by fitful glimpses in children acts and speeches remained as a permanency in the children's characters in the drift of the years, and were always afterwards clearly and definitely recognizable. There is a masterful streak in Jean that now and then moves her to set my authority aside for a moment and end a losing argument in that prompt and effective fashion. And here, in this old book, I find evidence that she was just like that before she was quite 4 years old. From the Children's Record, Quarry Farm, July 7, 1884. Yesterday evening our cows, after being inspected and worshipped by Jean from the shed for an hour, wandered off down into the pasture and left her bereft. I thought I was going to get back home now, but that was an error. Jean knew of some more cows in a field somewhere, and took my hand and led me thitherward. When we turned the corner and took the right-hand road, I saw that we should presently be out of range of call and sight, so I began to argue against continuing the expedition, and Jean began to argue in favor of it, she using language for light skirmishing and German for business. I kept up my end with vigor and demolished her arguments in detail, one after the other, till I judged I had her about cornered. She hesitated a moment, then answered up sharply, "Wir werden nicht mehr darüber sprechen. We won't talk any more about it." It nearly took my breath away, though I thought I might possibly have misunderstood. I said, "Why, you little rascal, was hast du gesagt?" But she said the same words over again, and in the same decided way. I suppose I ought to have been outraged, but I wasn't. I was charmed. And I suppose I ought to have spanked her, but I didn't. I fraternized with the enemy, and we went on, and spent half an hour with the cows. That incident is followed in the record by the following paragraph, which is another instance of a juvenile characteristic maintaining itself into mature age. Susie was persistently and conscientiously truthful throughout her life, with the exception of one interruption covering several months, and perhaps a year. This was while she was still a little child. Suddenly, not gradually, she began to lie, not furtively, but frankly, openly, and on a scale quite disproportioned to her size. Her mother was so stunned, so nearly paralyzed for a day or two, that she did not know what to do with the emergency. Reasonings, persuasions, beseechings, all went for nothing. They produced no effect. The lying went tranquilly on. Other remedies were tried, but they failed. There is a tradition that success was finally accomplished by whipping. I think the record says so, but if it does, it is because the record is incomplete. Whipping was indeed tried, and was faithfully kept up during 2 or 3 weeks, but the results were merely temporary. The reforms achieved were discouragingly brief. Fortunately for Susie, an incident presently occurred which put a complete stop to all the mother's efforts in the direction of reform. This incident was the chance discovery in Darwin of a passage which said that when a child exhibits a sudden and unaccountable disposition to forsake the truth and restrict itself to lying, the explanation must be sought away back in the past, that an ancestor of the child had had the same disease at the same tender age, that it was irremovable by persuasion or punishment, and that it had ceased as suddenly and as mysteriously as it had come, when it had run its appointed course. I think Mr. Darwin said that nothing was necessary but to leave the matter alone, and let the malady have its way, and perish by the statute of limitations. We had confidence in Darwin, and after that day Susie was relieved of our reformatory persecutions. She went on lying without let or hindrance during several months or a year. Then the lying suddenly ceased, and she became as conscientiously and exactingly truthful as she had been before the attack, and she remained so to the end of her life. The paragraph in the record to which I have been leading up is in my handwriting, and is of a date so long posterior to the time of the lying malady that she had evidently forgotten that truth-speaking had ever had any difficulties for her. Mama was speaking of a servant who had been pretty unveracious, but was now trying to tell the truth. Susie was a good deal surprised, and said she shouldn't think anybody would have to try to tell the truth. In the record, the children's acts and speeches quite definitely define their characters. Susie's indicated the presence of mentality, thought, and they were generally marked by gravity. She was timid on her physical side, but had an abundance of moral courage. Clara was sturdy, independent, orderly, practical, persistent, plucky, just a little animal and very satisfactory. Charles Dudley Warner said Susie was made of mind and Clara of matter. When Motley, the kitten, died, someone said that the thoughts of the two children need not be inquired into, they could be divined, that Susie was wondering if this was the end of Motley, and had his life been worth while, whereas Clara was merely interested in seeing to it that there should be a creditable funeral. In those days Susie was a dreamer, a thinker, a poet, and philosopher, and Clara, well, Clara wasn't. In after years a passion for music developed the latent spirituality and intellectuality in Clara, and her practicality took second, and in fact even third, place. Jean was from the beginning orderly, steady, diligent, persistent, and remained so. She picked up languages easily and kept them. Susie, aged 11, Jean 3. Susie said the other day, when she saw Jean bringing a cat to me of her own motion, "Jean has found out already that Mama loves morals and Papa loves cats." It is another of Susie's remorselessly sound verdicts. As a child, Jean neglected my books. When she was 9 years old, Will Gillette invited her and the rest of us to a dinner at the Murray Hill Hotel in New York, in order that we might get acquainted with Mrs. Leslie and her daughters. Elsie Leslie was 9 years old, and was a great celebrity on the stage. Jean was astonished and awed to see that little slip of a thing sit up at table and take part in the conversation of the grown people, capably and with ease and tranquillity. Poor Jean was obliged to keep still, for the subjects discussed never happened to hit her level, but at last the talk fell within her limit, and she had her chance to contribute to it. Tom Sawyer was mentioned, and Jean spoke gratefully up and said, "I know who wrote that book, Harriet Beecher Stowe." One evening Susie had prayed, Clara was curled up for sleep. She was reminded that it was her turn to pray now, and she said, "Oh, one's enough," and dropped off to slumber. Clara, 5 years old. We were in Germany. The nurse, Rosa, was not allowed to speak to the children otherwise than in German. Clara grew very tired of it. By and by the little creature's patience was exhausted, and she said, "Aunt Clara, I wish God had made Rosa in English." Clara, 4 years old, Susie, 6. This morning, when Clara discovered that this is my birthday, she was greatly troubled because she had provided no gift for me, and repeated her sorrow several times, Finally she went running to the nursery, and presently returned with her newest and dearest treasure, a large toy horse, and said, "You shall have this horse for your birthday, Papa." I accepted it with many thanks. After an hour she was racing up and down the room with the horse, when Susie said, "Why, Clara, you gave that horse to Papa, and now you've tooken it again." "Clara, I never give it to him for always. I give it to him for his birthday." In Geneva, in September, I lay abed late one morning, and as Clara was passing through the room, I took her on my bed a moment. Then the child went to Clara Spaulding and said, "Aunt Clara, Papa is a good deal of trouble to me."
"Is he? Why?"
"Well, he wants me to get in bed with him, and I can't do that with Jelmuls, gentlemen. I don't like Jelmuls anyway."
"What, you don't like gentlemen? Don't you like Uncle Theodore Crane?"
"Oh, yes, but he's not a Jelmul. He's a friend."
Mark Twain, to be continued.